Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have completed a full season of Star Trek for the sake of making a podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. These are all going out, right? Like, people know about this?
Yes. So many people know about it. We're getting emails from all corners of the globe.
It's hard to believe there was ever a time when we made this show that people didn't. Like, our intention from the start was to just vanity press the shit out of this.
Yeah, well, and I think it was about episode 5 that our friend Sarus Farvar wrote. I mean, he's our friend now. We didn't really know him at that time, but he wrote a very nice article about us in Ars Technica, which really, really blew up the spot. And I guess the rest is history, Adam.
Sure is. This is sort of a celebratory episode, isn't it? The end of season for the show, end of the first season for our podcast.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, looking back, season one is full of pretty rough episodes, and we've had a couple episodes where it took the redemptive power of Riker boner jokes to make fun out of what was otherwise, you know, pretty dismal television. But overall, I think season one maybe gets a worse rap than it deserves.
Yeah, I think, you know, sexualizing anything that is devoid of sexualization can make anything a little more fun.
Yeah. And I think that it's been very cathartic for me as well, like thinking back to my West Hot American summer, thinking back to your trip to the trading card dealer.
Yeah.
You know, and the various other embarrassing moments we've suffered, some of the new embarrassing moments that we've had since we started this show.
Sort of like the end of this episode we're about to review. You know, there are so many more adventures ahead for us in the realm of embarrassment that I'm really excited to see what's out there, both for us and the show.
It is a guiding principle of Starfleet is based. Now, you can't find it within yourself to stand up, tell the truth. You don't deserve to wear that uniform.
Well, I guess we should probably kick it off, huh?
Yeah. Coming up for us is the season finale of season one, called The Neutral Zone. And it's your pretty standard unfrozen caveman lawyer episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
I don't understand your complicated cellular technology.
Sometimes when I get a message on my fax machine, I wonder, did little demons get inside and type it? I don't know.
So the opening shot is kind of a circa 1990s NASA space probe looking thing flying around in space outside of the Enterprise, and they're doing some scans. They're like, this is an old hunk of space junk, and normally like an interesting enough discovery, but the captain is coming back from an important conference, and
again with the conferences.
Yeah. This time he remember to take off his plastic name badge before he walked outside of the convention center.
Hope he remembered his dot bag this time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you forget any toiletries, you can just ring down at the front desk.
Mm-hmm. They have everything up to and including a dental dam available, which may or may not double as a shower cap.
There are no dental dams in the future, just like I'm pretty sure there are no dental dams in the present.
Yeah, they're called shower caps, Adam. But Data kind of puts in a word with Riker and says, hey, we have a couple hours before the captain gets back, and I would love to poke around on this on this junk that is floating around out here and see what's what.
He wants to poke the junk.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Data's not above poking the junk.
He is fully functional.
Yeah, trained in every technique. And Riker's like, all right, as long as you're back on board and ready to go before the captain's shuttlecraft docks, like, go sick, do whatever you want. And Data starts walking off the bridge, and Riker's like, Worf, you go with him. And this is a great moment for me because Data looks so excited that Worf is going to get on the turbo lift with him. It's like Brent Spiner, like, made very few choices to be, like, visibly emotional with this character. And this is, you know, and it's, like, definitely, like, outside of what the character should be capable of. But it was so sweet. Like, Worf is, like, walking over to the turbo lift, and Data just has, like, a big old grin on his face. Like, yeah, my buddy Worf is coming! Woo!
I guess if there's one person who could understand what it's like to be Data more than anyone on the ship, it's got to be Worf, right? They're the two outcasts. They're the two others. Maybe that's what Data understands.
I feel that. So they beam over to this thing, and there's kind of a lot more lights on than you would think for a 370-year-old space probe. But the computer's still working, the solar generator is still working, and they get it all fired up, and there's a big door, big circular door, and Worf walks over to it and does what I like to call the Klingon pratfall, which is when you walk into an automatic door that doesn't automatically trigger.
I was surprised that he didn't leave a big grease stain, like, where his forehead is.
Or just, like, make a Kool-Aid man hole in it, you know? Like, oh, yeah! Like, he's a Klingon. He's a tough dude. He should just bust right through that fucker.
Well, he wasn't strong enough to open it. He gave that job to Data.
Yeah, well, he Worf is taking his job as the muscle of the Enterprise very seriously, so he's not thinking too hard about...
He wanted to blow the thing open with a phaser, which was a great instinct, I thought.
Yeah. He's really like... The spirit of Tasha Yar is alive and well in Lieutenant Worf. But they get the door open, and it's full of these tubes that any seasoned sci-fi watcher will immediately identify as cryostasis chambers. And they start, like, rubbing the ice and frost away from the windows. And the first couple that they do it on have, like, ghoulish desiccated corpses in them. But the third one has a hot blonde inside of it.
This reveal was meant to be pretty shocking. They do that thing where they wipe the condensation from the window of the chamber and reveal a couple of dead guys, a couple of crispy critters, and then before revealing the live ones. And this brought to mind maybe a little game I can play with you. Ben, you want to play a game with me?
I'll play a game.
The game is called What Can the Enterprise Sensors Detect? And it's a simple game. You can either answer yes or no to the following items. And you just tell me whether the Enterprise sensors can detect the following things. Okay?
Okay. Lay it on me.
Ships.
Yes. I'll say yes.
All right. Planets.
Yes.
Weapons.
Yes.
No, that's actually wrong. Sensors detect weapons, and we know this from the many people that they've beamed on board the ship that have either had weapons on them, had weapons, like squirreled away on their person, like parts of weapons, or their hands were weapons themselves, like those electric eel hillbillies that we got a couple episodes ago.
That's true.
So wrong answer there. And then finally, life signs.
Yeah.
Here's why I ask that. Why the hell is this a surprise to anyone?
Yeah.
Like I mean, they should have picked this up.
This is clearly a problem with, I mean, they're able to detect like signs of life on planet surfaces, which are much further away and through all these interfering things like atmosphere and magnetospheres, when they're
all
in
the
orbit
spheres.
Over planets. But like a tin can that's been floating in space for 400 years with no real shielding of any kind, they're like, whoa, there's bodies.
It should be the easiest thing for them to pick up on. And
yeah.
It doesn't, I mean, that wouldn't do us any favors in the drama department. But
no.
Maybe it would. Maybe it would be equivalent, you know? We're getting some life signs on this thing that's 500 years old. Why don't you go investigate?
What?
It would still be an effective reveal.
Yeah, opening that door would be a cool surprise, you know?
Sure.
Good point, Adam.
Type to ramble on about something everyone knows.
That is the cue for the opening credit sequence, and when we come back, Picard is returning, and you know, he's like docking in the shuttle bay, and Data radios up and says like, hey guys, like you know, I don't think we should just leave these bodies. Like this probe is headed for a sun. It's gonna burn up if nobody does anything about it, and it just feels weird to leave these people here. So why don't we take them with us, and we'll figure something out later. So Riker's like, "All right, you can do that."
You can't help but wonder, seeing an episode in a storyline like this, would you want to be frozen and then reanimated in a 24th century future? Do you have a position on this?
I mean, you know, it's definitely something I thought a lot about as a kid, probably in no small part due to this episode introducing the idea to me.
Yeah.
But I haven't thought about it so much as an adult, which is sort of when you kind of make those kinds of decisions. I mean, like, I don't even know if it's still a thing. Like can you still get a cryonics package for when you die, or?
I think so. I think that's still a thing.
Well, I would look into it, but I don't think my wife would allow it.
Oh no. When you die, she wants you to stay dead.
Yeah.
I think my wife would probably agree.
So Picard gets on the bridge, and he is like got a real bee in his bonnet about getting underway, and he gives Geordi some coordinates to head toward it. Warp 8, which is almost as warpy as you can get. And Geordi goes, "Captain, that's neutral zone territory you're heading us into." And Picard's like, "Yeah, Geordi, I'm the fucking captain. Like, I know what I'm doing." But you know, no sooner has he had Geordi lay in this course than he calls a big meeting, and this is a bunch of the senior staff get together in the wardroom and talk about the fact that stuff is up in the neutral zone. There are some outposts that they've lost contact with, and it's all along the neutral zone. And the only thing that the Federation can kind of come up with is the idea that this is a foray into Federation space by the Romulans, who haven't really been heard of in a long time. Like they've been out of the picture in a big way.
Yeah, for like 50 years. I think it was mentioned.
Yeah.
This storyline, you might think, is the A story to this episode, but it's not.
No.
I feel like the whole neutral zone Romulan storyline constitutes maybe 10% of the overall episode, which
I think
to me
was
fair. An interesting choice.
Yeah, I mean, it's where all of the menace and tension in the episode is. Like, I mean, this scene that we're talking about, like, you know, when the neutral zone comes up, Worf is like, Romulans, and Picard is is like, yeah, that's what we're kind of thinking. And the music is tense. Like I think the acting is really good. They're all like definitely like, oh shit, like things are about to pop off. And then it winds up being kind of a, like almost a stage play. Like almost all of this episode takes place in one room.
Right.
Which we'll get to momentarily.
One of the things I was considering when I was watching this scene was like how much planning was involved for an interaction that they were looking forward to versus how much of it they would just leave for the moment. Like they just sort of round table what they were going to do when they ever met up with the Romulans. And, you know, a good part of the room was like, we got to go in there and kick some ass. Like that's what they're going to respect. But it's Picard's thinking, and it's the thinking of the people that he was in the conference with, that they've got to go out there pretty chill. And
yeah, they don't want to ruffle the feathers of these warbirds.
Right, right.
Just kept talking in one long, incredibly unbroken sentence, moving from topic to topic so that no one had the chance to interrupt. It was really quite hypnotic.
Going to the other storyline, Crusher has thawed out the humans.
Which is a pretty crazy executive decision. Like, these are aboard. I guess I'll revive them.
Yeah, I wish we got to see that too. I don't know. That would have been fun. So yeah. This is also done completely outside of Picard's knowledge as well. So
yeah,
Crusher tells Picard that this has happened after the fact. So the captain rolls into sick bay to check it out, and there he's confronted with our three surviving capsule people.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, pretty quick to hop on the communicator and call Data down to the bridge, and it's pretty evident that Data is in big trouble. It's like I almost, like when Data is on the bridge and like gets up from his chair, I almost wanted everybody else to be like, ooh.
Yeah, that was a real sitcom live studio audience moment right there.
Yeah, seriously.
So let's meet our three unfrozen cavemen, okay?
Yeah.
We've got Claire, the homemaker, who was the first one that they wiped the condensation off of. That was the first one that they saw in the capsule. She's like a real mom vibe lady.
Yeah.
I want to say she's like in her 40s, you know, pretty average looking. I think they're all pretty average looking. We've got Ralph, the financier, who's played by Peter Mark Richman, who I read was a character actor of 500 TV roles. I didn't even know that was possible. 500 roles.
Damn.
Yeah, he so looks that guy's been like, around.
You know, our friend John Roderick, in his famous roasting of us on his Roadwork podcast, accused us of looking like people from the past.
Yeah.
Ralph Offenhaus looks like a man from the past. Like, yep. he looks like somebody that like started a brewery in the 1800s, you know?
He looks like if leather and tobacco could be a person.
Yeah,
that is Peter Mark Richman. I feel like I've seen him in everything too. He's a total that guy.
Absolutely.
And our third guy, his name is LQ Sonny Clements, who is a musician who we're told died of a drug overdose, or at least he was in severe organ failure before he was put into the capsule. And he's another
Much in the same way that Johnny Carson used to send monologue jokes to David Letterman well after Carson retired, I feel like Nancy Reagan sent a few a few like bits for Captain Picard to get on his high horse about Sonny Clemons being a drug user.
Right, and Sonny Clemons is played by Leon Rippey, and you might know him from Deadwood. Did you ever watch Deadwood?
No, we've actually talked about this off air before. I never watched it.
Well, it's fantastic, and he played Tom Nuttall, one of the saloon owners in Deadwood, and he is amazing in that show. He's amazing in an amazing show.
Nice.
So there's our three unfrozen cavemen, and they are a little shocked to be there.
Yeah, and you know, like, I feel like this premise has been done in sci-fi a million times. I'm actually reading a novel right now called Ancillary Justice, where one of the characters has been frozen for 1,000 years and is newly back to the living world and kind of trying to adjust to it. And I feel like the moments of, like, first sort of being, you know, having the situation laid on them, mm-hmm. are not that, like, they don't really play up what a crazy head fuck that is, you know?
The only one who seems shocked is Claire, and that's just at seeing Worf's forehead.
Right, yeah. She was like, boy, that meatloaf went real bad.
The other two seem more or less okay. They just seem concerned about their surroundings and their possessions.
Yeah, she didn't sign up for being put on ice.
Yeah, she was the only one there against her will, yeah.
So these people were put on ice in 1994. It's now 370 years later. And they kind of each have a different agenda. Ralph Offenhaus really thinks quite highly of himself and thinks he's super rich and that he's got, you know, bank assets that are just going to be incredibly valuable at this point.
I have to phone Geneva right away about my accounts. By the interest alone could be enough to buy this ship.
So that's his deal. Claire is very upset that she's been disconnected from her family.
I keep thinking about my boys.
I mean, she also, I think these other two guys knew that they were dying when they died, and she had like a brain aneurysm or something like that and just kind of like dropped dead at the age of 35. So she's got a lot more to go through. You know, she had two sons and a husband that she's never going to see again. And at one point, like, Troy comes and kind of helps her try and look at the genealogical records that the Mormons have no doubt loaded into the memory banks of the Enterprise. And that's like very therapeutic for her. And Sonny is just chilling, but he's kind of bored.
What do you guys do? I mean, you don't drink and you ain't got no TV.
Like, he wants to get a party going and he calls Data down to like start making plans for a party. And it's at this point that Data kind of goes like, yeah, but like first we have to deal with these Romulans. And,
well, we won't be inviting these Romulans to our party, will we?
No, that would not be appropriate.
I think the three of these characters embody maybe the three most likely outcomes for anyone who has been frozen and then reanimated. Like, that was my take anyway. There's like three different stages of grief or adjustment based on, sure, on that kind of knowledge. Like, Claire, you know, very clearly is like the most emotionally rattled by it. Just in the context of like the loss of her family and everyone that she knows. The financier, Ralph, he clearly is most concerned about his possessions.
Yeah. I mean, and he's really, it's like, it's, and it's so funny. Like, he's like, can somebody at least get me a copy of the Wall Street Journal? Which is like, I mean, that's so fun to think about, right? Like, the Wall Street Journal has been around for probably like a couple hundred years or like 150 years or something like that. Impossible to know for sure, but, something in that neighborhood. Is there a way to imagine a future 370 years from now in which the Wall Street Journal still exists?
Well, if J.J. Abrams's Star Trek movie reboot proved one thing, it's that, you know, if a brand like Budweiser can exist, then I wouldn't put it past the fine newspaper like the Wall Street Journal from surviving all that time.
Yeah, well, let's hope that we're headed for the Star Trek The Next Generation future and not the J.J. Abrams Star Trek future, because I don't want there to still be Budweiser that far in our future.
Yeah, I think that pretty clearly means that we have not evolved as a species.
No, that shit sucks.
You know what? We better stop right there. We don't want to limit any sort of ad opportunities going forward. Yeah.
Well, you know, obviously Budweiser, not to our taste, but Bud Light Limerita is delicious. And no,
I'm gonna remain disgusted neutral right now. With respect to any sort of Budweiser ad opportunity on our show.
That's another D&D characterization.
Yeah, yeah. As we're learning about each of these three characters, we also come to find that Dr. Crusher has cured all of them from whatever malady they had when they were put into the tube. So Claire's embolism, fine. Ralph's heart attack, no problem. Clemens' total organ failure due to drug and alcohol abuse, totally reversed, and he's fine.
Yeah.
In fact, the first thing he wants to do is order a martini out of the replicator, which seems like a move that you and I could really appreciate.
Yeah. I think this is the first time we see the replicator in action, too.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Cool that it was a martini that that got made. This is such a funny scene, too, because he's like ordering like a big old like barbecue meal, and then he's like, oh, heck, I'll just have a martini. Which is like, I've never been in the mood for both barbecue and a martini. Pick one.
I guess if you're given the choice of choosing anything in the world ever to eat or drink in one moment, I guess you could go between those two.
The Sonny character, Sonny Clemens character, he's played for so much comedy. At some point, he proposes that he and Data go find a couple of low-mileage pit woofies.
Why don't you come back later on? You and me will find us a couple of low-mileage pit woofies and help them build a memory.
He's speaking Riker's language with that.
Well, that's the funny thing, is that, like, Data asks Riker what he meant by that, and Riker, like, attempts to lie to Data and say that that's one that he didn't know either.
Commander, a low-mileage pit woofie?
This time you've got me. I haven't a clue.
But clearly Riker is just like, no, like, I'm going to tell Data I don't know what a low-mileage pit woofie is, and then I'm going to run back and see if Sonny wants to head to the holodeck with me.
Right. I mean, they could put together two piles of pit woofies.
Yeah. Oh, man, there's going to be pit woofies as far as the eye can see.
Pit woofie pile. No dental dams in the future, Ben.
Nope. Yeah. Or shower caps. But Offenhaus is really the antagonist of this episode, and he's really like a full-blown Ferengi. Like, all he cares about is his money, and really, like, is super condescending to Captain Picard. He's like, you know, like, you're a military man, and that's fine and noble or whatever, but it's not what a man of excellence like myself gets into to make a living.
Yeah, you're no banker.
Yeah, you can't possibly imagine, like, the kind of stress I'm under. But he starts to really get into Picard's lack of hair, because he wanders out of the room that they've been asked to wait in, thus further cementing how important it is that at some point they get some locks installed in the fucking doors on the Enterprise, and wanders into a turbo lift and makes it onto the bridge while the Enterprise is making contact with a cloaked Romulan ship.
Pretty much the worst timing possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not only is there a significant lock problem on the ship, but the idea that anyone on the ship, and we know this to be a ship of families and children, anyone could get on a turbo lift and go to the bridge at any point? That seems like a bad idea.
Well, I guess it's not like the worst idea if you know that, like, it's your ass if you go to the bridge without, you know, being authorized. But, like,
yeah, but a lot of little kids know it's their ass if they fuck up in a grocery store. And
that's true.
And it doesn't stop them from doing that.
And especially on a ship where at least one of the little kids, who is absent from this episode, wandered onto the bridge enough times to get a field commission to ensign. I would guess that a lot of the children on this ship are probably trying to pull some shit where they go on the bridge.
I'm sorry, is a field commission to ensign a euphemism for something?
Yeah, there's an ointment for that, actually.
You must be referring to Wesley.
The boy.
But yeah, so these Romulans appear on screen. One of them is the actor who will go on to play Gul Dukat in the Deep Space Nine series.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
But he's kind of the multi-purpose criminal element Cardassian guy.
He's a guy that the makeup effects people already have the cast of his forehead, and they just make different forehead molds for him.
Yeah.
All the different aliens.
Yeah. This scene with the Romulans is real weird, because they're kind of it's like a two shot with two Romulans sitting like hand in hand, essentially, on the bridge of their weird ship. And it's like, do these guys run this ship as like a couple, or like, is one of them in charge and the other not, or are they like co-captains?
Yeah, their bridge is sort of built around a love seat, it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really like their whole attitude. Like, I didn't find it overly threatening or non-threatening. Like, I just felt like they struck exactly the right tone of mystery and oddity. I mean, when they decloak the ship, that was a real wow moment. That's one of the coolest ships that I think we see in the entire series.
Yeah.
That Romulan ship.
It's hard to tell how big it is, because they, you know, the couple of angles that we get either show it like huge in the foreground and the Enterprise like pretty small, and you can't quite tell if that's because the Enterprise is very, very far away or because the Romulan ship is way, way bigger.
Yeah.
But it's imposing, and it's like really interesting design, and it's a very cool model.
The in the moments before this, though, the Enterprise has been going from sort of outpost to outpost. And yeah. And finding nothing. Like, I think they go to three different places, and the base or outpost that they're expecting to be there is either just, there's no evidence of it at all, or there's evidence that it's been completely destroyed. And I think that's an interesting bit of trivia, because once they get into a conversation with the Romulans refer to their own bases and outposts as being destroyed and, quote, carried off. Did you think that was an interesting terminology that they used for that?
Yeah, and that that's like, I mean, there's like, you think about TNG as being like every episode kind of gets tied up with a bow and nothing changes from episode to episode, and I really think that that's misleading, because this is like a huge storyline that runs through several seasons of the show. I mean, it's not like their only focus, and it's not something that comes up in episodes that aren't about this storyline, but this is planting like a pretty big seed. And it's interesting, because this episode doesn't wind up feeling very plotty at all, mm-hmm. because it's really setting the table for this becoming a big television series with like a whole bunch of seasons and, you know, and a lot of plots to come. There's almost not an A storyline in this episode. You know, it's like, it's hard to call the stuff with the unfrozen caveman lawyers the A storyline, and it's kind of hard to call the Romulan stuff the A storyline.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I kind of love that. Like, I think it's kind of great. Like, it's a weird episode, but it shows some sort of confidence almost. Like, I still think that like our discussion of the episode Conspiracy, you know, I do sort of wish that was the closer episode, but this episode is like, we're going to make like a great series, and this is the end of, you know, a rocky season one, but we're about to fucking blow your minds.
Yeah, it's, I think that word is interesting. The confidence word is interesting to me. I think you're right in the description of a writer's room maybe throwing out a bunch of threads just out into the distance, like loose ends that aren't tied up, you know, with the expectation or the hope that they would chase them down and resolve them.
Yeah.
And this moment contains, well, this episode contains a few of those, the relationship with the Romulans and the very thinly veiled reference to a Borg invasion.
Yeah, he winds up kind of getting them to agree to like sharing some information about what's going on, but they're such a great malevolent alien species because they end their communication with the Enterprise by saying like, we've been distracted by other more important issues, but make no mistake, Captain Picard, we are back.
One of their distractions is clearly not getting a good haircut because both of them clearly cut their own bangs. Some of the most ridiculous haircuts on the show so far are theirs.
Yeah, they got to get that Bolian barber shipped off to the Romulan Empire for a few years, put him onto some of the newest trends in hair care.
They're sporting the mushroom cuts of a special needs child.
Damok Angelad at Tanagra.
I think that they sort of, the writers probably at this point are realizing like having the Ferengi be the only kind of antagonistic species is pretty boring and pretty stupid. So why don't we just have like a whole pantheon of other aliens that they can encounter?
I think this is something that you could only do in a television series that's 25 episodes long in per season. Like they could create a storyline and then course correct either midway or at the end of a season, once they decide what's working and what's not. And, you know, in the modern television era where you get 12 episodes, you don't have that chance. If it doesn't work, then you're stuck with it. And then you're on to either season two or cancellation. And I think there's a latitude here that a long episode run per season really gives. And I think that's bared out here at the end. I mean, at least we're just speculating that that's what happened, but I mean, there's a reason that this threat is present and it's not another reference to the Ferengi.
As strange an episode as this is, I enjoyed watching it. How about you?
Yeah, definitely. I think it ends on a note that might be similar to our own. Like, there's possibilities that await new adventures that are out there.
More shame that we can talk about from our pasts and presents.
Yeah, I like that. I had a few things I wanted to discuss with you about this episode.
Lay them on me.
Some incongruities.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was strange that during maybe the most significant diplomatic interaction in, we're told, 50 years, that Counselor Troy is on Ancestry.com in some condo inside the ship instead of on the bridge.
Yeah.
And on the bridge instead is fucking Ralph.
Yeah. And there's two security guys that have been like tasked with getting him off the bridge, but they're so awed by the fact that they're looking at a Romulan warbird on the view screen that they like take their hands off of his upper arms and just stand there agog.
This wasn't an example of writing kung fu, like, in order to make a storyline work better, you know, you remove someone from the situation in order to add to the conflict. Like, I think the conflict still works if Troy's on the bridge. I think, if anything, it's more interesting if she's there.
Yeah.
But her absence is strange.
It is weird.
And it's not important that she's being a counselor to someone at that exact moment.
No, I mean, like, I feel like they could easily just put these three people in stasis so that they're not a bother while they're dealing with a potentially incredibly dangerous military situation.
Right. Another thing I thought was strange was, like, this is the only episode that I can remember that really addresses the audience and the audience's sensibilities directly. Like,
right.
Everything that the Enterprise crew makes fun of with regard to the unfrozen people are
the popsicle people.
Yeah, the popsicles are contemporary issues.
Yeah,
and they basically laugh at them for them. Like, they're a punchline.
Yeah,
and I don't recall them doing this ever again. I wonder if that was a choice. If they got in their licks in this first season episode and they were done with it, or what? But
Well, it's sort of a funny, like, reversal of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, you know, where it's like a fish out of water, but in the other direction.
A fish in the water?
Like a, I don't know.
A water on the fish?
Yeah. a rat in the water? I don't know.
I'm trying to help you.
A land animal in the water rather than a fish on the land.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
I don't know what the best animal to pick is, though, because I feel like a fish is like a generic whatever, but who cares? Whatever.
If you have any ideas of
right into
what animal should be in or out of the water in this particular metaphor, feel free to comment on Greatest Gen.
Or don't. Picard is pretty irritated by what a dickhole Ralph Offenhouse is, and... You know, Ralph Offenhouse is very condescending to Picard because he really doesn't know his ass from his elbow.
Were you sympathetic to all of them?
I mean, I think that Offenhouse is really played as a villain, and I nevertheless found there was something to sympathize with in his character. I mean, he had a few moments of vulnerability where you're like, wow, this guy is like, it's not that he's just a self-important asshole. He's fucking terrified.
Right. Yeah, I felt the same way. I think I didn't like him, but I understood him.
Yeah.
I am the cutest of all. Lock faces on that vessel. I am the cutest of all. There are four lights.
As you were watching, did you come across a great example of being a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, I mean, I have to go with Sonny Clemens because he... really wants to throw a party and get drunk while Romulans are buzzing around outside the ship. And what could be a drunker Shimoda than that, Adam? I'm sure you have an idea.
His priority, as soon as he gets unfrozen, is to get himself a beverage. And
yeah,
I think that's
go shake the doctor down for some pills.
Yeah, slap some doctor ass while he's at it.
Yeah, oh man, we have to talk about that really quickly. The fact that he... very brazenly sexually harasses the doctor and she just kind of blushes and demurs was a strange moment, I think. I mean, I think that this is supposed to be set in a future where gender inequality is more or less defeated. I mean, like, I don't think that they do a perfect job of representing that, but that's the stated ideal of the writers of the show.
I think it's weird that Sonny is supposed to be from our contemporary future as well. Like, he's supposed to be...
Right, this is 1989 and he was frozen in 94, so...
Oh, right, so I guess, like, but he's I guess, pretty modern by our standards. But in that case, like, he should know better, right? Do people do that now?
I think there's a certain kind of asshole that still does that.
Yeah, and he is a certain kind of asshole. I think it was so shocking to Beverly that I think she was completely frozen.
Yeah, much in the same way that he once was. Stupid.
I think Tasha would have kicked his fucking ass.
I think Tasha would have broken him in half.
Yeah.
She would have dropped him over her knee.
Yeah. I think Tasha would have beaten him up with that stupid guitar that that he made in the replicator.
Yeah, that like $5 carnival guitar.
It is one of the stupidest guitars you will ever see on television.
Who is your drunk Shimoda, Adam?
Oh, it's clearly Sonny, but okay. But I led to it. I referred to it a little earlier as the only drinker in the episode. I think it could only be him. As we bring our first season to a close, do you have any thoughts on what we've done here?
Well, Adam, this is not something I ever saw myself doing, but I've had a lot of fun doing it, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I think this has been a great success.
I think we've really made each other laugh in talking about this show, and at least a couple of dozen people have bothered to write us emails, and a couple hundred people that have been kind enough to leave us iTunes reviews have seemed to laugh as well.
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that and be grateful for it. I think it's been a pretty great experiment so far.
And I think we should, there's one thing that we should call out that we're both especially grateful for. And we're recording these well in advance, so this is going to be, you know, kind of old news at this point. But I think we can declare victory in our moose knuckle controversy. The guy that wrote our iTunes review, the one-star iTunes review, taking us to task for misusing the term moose knuckle, was kind enough to write in. He bumped us up to 4 stars on iTunes and admitted that we were right and he was wrong. And moose knuckle is more conventionally used for when a dude's genitals are all bunched up in a funny way in the front of his pants.
If we've accomplished one thing in our 26 episodes of this show, it's that. I feel great about it.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us what's up next for season 2, episode 1?
Episode 1, The Child. While preparing to transport a deadly plague to a research lab, the crew is stunned by the announcement of Counselor Troy's pregnancy?
Uh-oh. I can only assume that Riker is involved somehow.
Do you remember this episode at all?
No, I guess I don't.
There's two things that I do remember about this. One is that I remember there's a shot at the beginning of the episode that's like a weird, like, Steadicam or handheld shot of walking onto the bridge, and it's like somebody's point of view, but it really like pans around and you kind of see like Worf is now in his gold uniform. Like, it's like we are back, the fucking crew is better than ever, and here is what's popping off. And so I remember that, and I'm almost positive it's in this episode that that happens. And the other thing is that Troy has this kid, and it's like a Search for Spock situation where the kid, every time the camera cuts away from the kid and we go to another scene, we come back and it's like a different child actor that's like a couple years older.
Interesting. Okay.
It's like an accelerated growth period for this kid. But okay. I imagine they use that to heavily overintroduce Dr. Pulaski, who we will be getting to know quite well in the coming weeks.
Oh, that's right. Do you think Beverly's inability to defend against sexual harassment is a reason that she was kicked off the ship?
Oh, man, that is the worst kind of victim blaming.
I know. I'm sorry. This premiere of season 2 episode was described as uneven and an inauspicious start to the second season.
What?
Also, you could replace any main character in this episode with a parsnip, and the outcome would be unchanged.
Wow. Well, that is certainly not the root vegetable I would use to swap in for any Star Trek character, but, you know, I guess that's that reviewer's prerogative as a writer.
Well, I'm more excited to see this than ever. We get our vetoes back, don't we?
Yeah, well, we should think about that. Do we or do we not? We've been implored many times by listeners not to employ the veto because they want us to do shows about even the episodes that we hate watching.
Well, I think much like the Romulans in this episode, the threat should always be there.
Wow. Well, would you invoke a veto on the first episode of a season?
No. No, absolutely not.
I'm not going
not.
To either. So
I want
to
save
the point
it for,
is moot, at least.
For a Troy's mom episode, for sure.
Well, there's one per season, as far as I remember, so.
Looking forward to that.
With that, we should probably cut this off and go back to doing something less shameful than recording a Star Trek podcast. I've been Ben Harrison.
I've been Adam Pranica. If you ever want to talk about any episode this season, you can use the hashtag GreatestGen on Twitter. I am at CutForTime. Ben is at BenjaminAHR on Twitter.
We should thank Dark Materia for our wonderful, wonderful theme song. It's really Dark Materia's theme song. We just used it without asking and then asked for permission later, and he was kind enough to say yes.
Crime does pay.
And with that, we will be back at you next time with a great episode of Star Trek The Next Generation and a middling at best episode of The Greatest Generation. Bye.
See you next season.
Make it so. Jean Picard.